Good morning. If you would, remain standing for just a few moments. My name is Taylor. I'm an elder apprentice here at Redemption Hill. If you're a guest with us, thank you for being here. Typically, what we do is we take a book of the Bible and we preach through it line by line, verse by verse. So this morning, if you have a Bible, we'll be in Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 24. If you don't have a Bible, there's hardback black ones on either side of your row. Just tap someone on the shoulder. They'll be happy to pass one down to you. Mark is the second gospel in the New Testament. It's the second book of the New Testament. And again, that's Mark chapter 13, verse 24. I'm going to read this through to the end of the chapter. And then at the end, I'll say, this is the word of the Lord. If you would just respond with thanks be to God. So Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 24. But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. And the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake. For you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. We've been walking through a mini-series of sorts in the book of Mark on the end times. So this is, we're titling this, The End According to Jesus. And this would be part three of this. And this chapter, Mark 13, is often called the Olivet Discourse because Jesus and his disciples are outside the temple of Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. And one of his disciples has asked him a question, commenting on the greatness of the temple. And it sparked this long response from Jesus, not only about the temple, but really about the fate of Jerusalem and all of Israel. And so as we get started this morning, I just want to be very candid and honest with you. This particular passage is not the easiest to understand. And that's okay, because sometimes there's clear passages and sometimes there's more difficult ones. But the reason why it's a little bit more difficult is because Jesus is speaking prophetically. That is, he's revealing God's activity to come in this age as well as in the age to come. So he's going to be using metaphors and cosmic language of signs and symbols to communicate what's going to happen in the near future as well as what's going to happen a little bit farther on down the line. So to help us kind of give us a frame of reference to kind of grasp this and understand this, I'm going to use an illustration that's going to be kind of a constant through us, with us for throughout this message. So, how many have ever been mountain hiking or mountain climbing? Just show of hands. Good. Okay. So we live in Texas, but we love mountains because we don't see any of that here, and it's great to venture out and actually see beautiful mountains. The imagery works there here because remember, the disciples are also in this scene on the side of a mountain. They're overlooking the temple and Jerusalem. So we're going to pretend like we're all climbing up a mountain through this text, and Jesus is our God, okay? So we're climbing up. He's paved a way. The last few weeks, Brad's done a great job of showing us that a lot of what we've talked about up to this point is talking about what is going to happen in the near future, namely the destruction of the temple in the year AD 70. And so today in our journey, we're going to the top of this proverbial mountain, okay? We're going to see where all of this leads to. And we're going to get an apex view of all of what Jesus has described up to this point, as well as get a glimpse of what lies beyond the mountains. But in order to see this, first we have to go to the top with him. So really, this message is going to be divided into two parts, okay? Part one is going to be the mountain that we see in the nearest distance. We'll call this the destruction of the temple and the enthronement of Jesus, okay? And then in part two, it's as if Jesus is going to say, you see what's ahead of you. Now I'm going to show you kind of what's lying beyond, okay? And so here's how I want your heart to be. Here's how I want your disposition to be when I show you what's coming beyond all of this. So we'll call part two the return of the king after our dear brother Tolkien. Sound good? That's kind of where we're going this morning, okay? So grab your Bibles. We're going to be in the Bible this morning because I really don't have anything else to tell you. I don't have really a lot of funny stories. I'll maybe share one or two, but I want us to be in the text this morning. So let's start in verse 24. Jesus says, "But in those days after that tribulation," now stop there. Okay, so Jesus is saying is referencing something that he's already mentioned in the prior verse. If you scroll up a little bit in your Bible or on your phone, if you look at verse 19, he says, "For in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been." So notice that Jesus says, "in those days," referencing what he's talking about in verse 19. So what does this mean? It means that from the get-go, everything that we're going to read here from 24 on to about verse 32 is talking about the collapse of the temple, okay? So that's kind of where we're at. So let's continue. "The sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heaven will be shaken." Okay, so how do we take this? Because this can all kind of sound very confusing. This is cosmic language. We're talking about the sun and the moon and the stars and the powers of heaven. What can this possibly have to do with the destruction of the temple that's coming? Here's what's going on. Jesus is speaking prophetically here. Remember, in these times, the Bible of Jesus and the Bible of his contemporaries is the Old Testament. And so when we come across this, we kind of need to ask ourselves, where have we seen this before? Where have we seen this language of moon and stars and powers in heaven being shaken before? Well, we see it in the prophets. Take a listen. This is from Isaiah 13. "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light, and the sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light." Here's Ezekiel 32. "When I blot you out, I will cover the heavens and make their stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light." Again, Joel 2, "The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, the stars withdraw their shining." So in the Old Testament, with prophetic texts like the ones you just read, when you see this language of astronomy, okay, this language of astronomical phenomena, that sun, the moon, the stars, Usually, that's used figuratively to describe the upheaval of earthly dynasties, okay? So the language isn't talking about what's going on in the heavens. It's talking about what's going on in the earth and in government and in politics. So these signs are about what's going on in the Jewish world. This is a sign of the end of the Jewish world as they know it. So one New Testament scholar puts it this way. He says, Jesus isn't really describing the end of the world, like the entire world, but the end of a world, the symbolic universe of the first century Judaism connected with the temple. All that the temple stood for is out, and the Son of Man is in. So we have this prophetic language describing the fate of Jerusalem, right? Okay, so we're climbing up this mountain, and we're about to get to the top now. We're about to see all that Jesus is talking about here. So let's keep going on verse 26. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Okay, so how does this work, right? Because we read this, and it sounds like the Son of Man, which most of us know is Jesus, it's a reference to himself, is going to come from heaven down to the earth on the clouds with great power and glory, right? Well, here's where I say, not exactly, okay? Remember, we want the Old Testament to be our guide here, because Jesus is making a direct reference to Daniel chapter 7. Listen to Daniel 7. This is Daniel 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. So do you hear that language coming to the Ancient of Days? For those of you that don't know, Ancient of Days is a reference to Yahweh, to God of the Old Testament. So what I'm going to argue for here is that this is Jesus coming to the right hand of the Father, right? So this isn't a movement down from heaven to earth, but rather a movement from earth up to the heavens. This is about the Son of Man being enthroned as the Messiah and King when Jesus ascends to the right hand of the Father, and he goes to the cloud up to the Ancient of Days. And I think this is solidified when we see Jesus standing trial in the presence of the high priest Caiaphas. If you have a Bible, go back to Matthew chapter 26 and look in verse 63. This is really cool. Jesus is on trial. He's standing before the high priest. He's being questioned, and he's remaining silent. And Caiaphas finally says, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Isn't that interesting? He's saying, from now on, you will see me at the right hand of the Father. And this is really what makes Caiaphas tear his robes and say, execute this man, because he's equating himself with Yahweh. He's putting himself next to the right hand of the Ancient of Days. This is blasphemy to a first century Jew. And here's what's important about this for us, because we don't always emphasize this, but we should. The ascension of Jesus after his resurrection, the ascension of Jesus to the right hand of the Father is part of the gospel message. The enthronement of Jesus Christ means he is exalted above all things and holds all authority on heaven and earth. It means he is vindicated. Vindication is a law court term, and it means the act by which someone is proven right or justified. So if somebody is on trial and is accused of something wrongfully, the only thing that can vindicate them is if it turns out their testimony is true and that they're telling the truth about themselves and that evidence supports that. So when Jesus ascends to the right hand of the Father, this is living proof that he is indeed the Son of Man, that he is God incarnate, that he's come from the Lord and he's returning to the Lord as the enthroned king who accomplished his mission to seek and save the lost, to save a people for himself. He shows himself to be the righteous Son of Man before all of his enemies, including Caiaphas, right? Okay, so we see that he's going to be vindicated, but you might be asking, okay, so what does this have to do with the destruction of the temple? How does this event that happened 40 years prior connect with what's going to happen in Jerusalem? And as I was studying this, I felt like Michael Scott from The Office. Like I was looking at my books and saying, "What, you know, why don't you explain this to me like I'm five?" You know, because with a lot of this, this can be hard to grasp. So what does this have to do with the temple's destruction? Well, if we look at Matthew 24, which is the parallel account to the text we're in today, Mark 13, Matthew 24 gives us a little bit more context as to how the enthronement of Jesus and his vindication is connected to the destruction of the temple. So here's Matthew 24, verse 30. Here's what it says. "And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." So Jesus is saying that the sign that the Son of Man is indeed at the right hand of the Father is the destruction of the temple on earth. It's a sign that when the temple is collapsing, when the Romans are invading, when everything is on fire, you will know that he is at the right hand of the Father next to the Ancient of Days. And you might be asking, okay, that's kind of strange. Why would he want his followers to look at such a horrific event as the collapse of the temple and connect that to him being at the right hand of the Father? Why would he want them to know that? Well, it's actually not all that uncommon for us to associate these things, even in our modern age. So consider with me 9/11 for a moment. September 11th, 2001, was one of the most horrific events in our nation's history. Two hijacked planes crashed into the World Trade Center. Another one hit the Pentagon. And yet, every year around September 11th, what do we say? We say, "Never forget." And we don't say it primarily to think about the horror and the trauma that so many men experienced that day, though that is real. We say it because we never want to forget the price that so many brave men and women did that day to save their fellow citizens. Countless first responders went into burning buildings, risking their own health and welfare and their own lives and children to save other Americans. We say never forget because our nation has never been the same since that day. For better or for worse, it changed the course of American history forever. And it's very, very similar to the temple in AD 70. When the temple collapsed and Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, it marked the end of the Jewish age. Nothing was the same after that. And so Jesus is saying, when you see the temple fall, never forget. Never forget that I'm on the throne, that I've been vindicated for what I'm telling you right now before all my enemies. Never forget the lengths that I go to save my people, to save us by going to the cross and forgiving sins and rising 3 days later and now ascended at the right hand of the Father. The collapse of the temple is a sign that all people can come to the throne of Jesus, not just Jewish people. It means that Jesus is God over all things, and that if you don't know him today, you can surrender your life to the true King who sits on the throne of love. It means that God is a global God. We'll see this in the next verse. Look at verse 27. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. We can't spend too much time on this verse, but here's what I think it means. Hebrews 1 refers to spiritual beings, angels that are sent out to serve for the sake of those who inherit salvation. So if you remember, after Jesus rises from the dead, he gives the Great Commission to his disciples. He commissions his earthly followers on the earth to go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey all that I have commanded you. And then he ascends to the Father, and then he sends out his heavenly angels to assist in gospel ministries. And there's more that we can say on this, but it's important to know here that Jesus is a global God, and he desires to gather his people from all over the world long before the temple has even fallen at this point. So we come now to verses 28 through 31. This is the lesson of the fig tree. Jesus is going to point to this as an illustration of what he's just described prior. Remember, he's still answering the question that was asked earlier in the chapter of when will these things take place? And to paraphrase it, he says, just as you see the branches bud and the leaves begin to sprout in the summer, you will know that I am near at the very gates. Now we look at that again, and naturally we want to think that it's talking about the end of all things because he's near, he's at the gates, right? But look at the next verse. He says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So everything that I've said above, this generation won't pass away until all of this takes place. In those days, a generation was about 40 years. So remember, for if we're putting ourselves in the shoes of the first century Jews, this was the end. It was the end of their people, their city, their temple. And so when Jesus says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away, he's saying that your world is going to be destroyed, but remember what I've said here, because my words are certain and they don't pass away. Which leads us to two things I think that we can take away practically from this section. Number one, Jesus is who he says he is. He's the Son of Man. He's the Messiah. He is God. All of these things happen exactly as he said they would happen. 40 years before, all of this took place. He is our perfect prophet. And because of that, because of what he's done in the gospel and the events of the destruction of the temple, Jesus Christ, now and forevermore, is vindicated for all time. And the second thing is that the ascension of Jesus matters to the gospel. Not just because it's a sign of fulfillment, but because in the ascension, Jesus is enthroned as king at the right hand of the Father. In the Great Commission, Jesus says all authority on heaven and earth has been given to him. He's risen. He knows where he's going. He knows what he's doing. And so whatever you came in with this morning, whatever your pain or stress you're walking through, what if we considered the ascension this morning? What if we remembered that the Jesus we worship is always playing the long game? Have you considered that Jesus is on his throne and therefore is glad to hear his people call out to him? And he sits at the right hand of the Father, victorious over sin, interceding and praying on our behalf that we might make it. The reality is that the current heaven and the current earth will pass away. Your family drama will pass away. Your suffering will pass away. Your disease will pass away. and you and I will pass away. But his words, those don't pass away. They are more firm and secure than creation itself, more than everything visible to the naked eye, more than the chair that you're sitting in and the roof over your head. The words of Jesus are eternally secure. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. He's certain. He's true. And he's coming again. So we come now to the second half of this text. Remember our mountain imagery. We're at the top of the mountain with Jesus. And he's just shown us the peak that's closest to us. So when you're on a mountain, you're climbing up, you can often see just one mountain. And then when you get to the top, you realize there's a whole range of mountains that are on top of that one peak that you were seeing. And so now it's as if Jesus is going to switch gears and say, okay, you see that farther peak over there, the one that looks like it was right on the top of the closest one. Now I'm going to talk about that mountain range way over there, because that's my return. It's a very significant mountain, okay? So look at verse 32. We're shifting here. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. And here's why I think he's shifting. Here's why I think he's pointing to that farther mountain range. Notice the language. He's not saying in those days anymore, referring to what's come before, but he says that day, that hour. This is why it's important to read the Bible closely, because if we just read it once, we're going to miss things. It's a subtle but intentional shift from the plural to the singular. So in the first half of the text, he's giving us signs of the destruction to come in the short term, in the next 40 years. But if we pay careful attention, he's not talking about that anymore. Now, he's talking about his second coming. And another reason we know it's about his second coming is just by following his logic, because it wouldn't make too much sense to outline all of these signs and seasons when the destruction of Jerusalem will occur, and then to follow it up with, yeah, but you never know. You don't know when it's coming. That wouldn't make much sense. No, instead, he's speaking of his return. Nobody knows the day of the Son of Man's return. It's only for the Father to know. And so now we finally get to the point of what he's communicating here. We finally come to the thrust of this passage. At long last, we're atop the mountain, and Jesus is going to communicate what he wants us to hear. And it's this, it's verse 33. Be on guard, keep awake. Verse 35, therefore stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. Again, verse 37, he's going to say it one more time. What I say to you, I say to all. That means us. Stay awake. So we can be sure that he's talking about a day that hasn't come yet. And so the charge for us is to stay awake. Now, here's what that doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that we obsess about the when of Jesus's return. So it's unwise for us to get caught up in timelines and charts and current world events. When we think about the end, we don't want to do newspaper eschatology. That's newspaper eschatology is looking at the newspaper, the current events of the world, and then going back to the Bible to see how Russia or China or Ukraine somehow fits into some prophecy taken out of context in the book of Revelation. We don't want to do that. We want to go to the Bible first and hear what Jesus says, not network news. We get our understanding from Scripture first, not TikTok. Heaven forbid, no TikTok. But instead, what it means to stay awake is that we awake ourselves to the reality that Jesus is coming back. We don't know when, but we're aware that it's a certainty. We awake ourselves to this. And the key is that we don't do it in fear. And this is something that I've personally struggled with, and it's taken me a long time to overcome, because I'll give you an example. When I was about 10 years old, I read the kids series of Left Behind, and I watched the movie with Kirk Cameron. And it scared me to my core. The rapture was portrayed as this horrific global event in which all Christians everywhere get snatched up and their clothes are like perfectly on the floor folded up. And so the point of me sharing this is not to bash Left Behind, because they get enough criticism these days, but genuinely, this is my experience as a kid. It made me worry about Jesus coming back. And so if I couldn't find my mommy or my daddy in the house, it had been like 5 minutes, my heart would start racing and I'd go, this is it. I'm left behind. This is over. I got to find Kirk Cameron. And so for years, this is how I thought about the second coming of Christ, that it's going to be this horrific scene of tragedy and utter despair, of surprise, because at any moment, you could wake up and everybody you know is just gone. But that's not staying awake. That's fear. That's fear that one, I'm not really a Christian, and two, that the end of all things is going to be this horrible event of war and unrighteousness. And look, I'm not saying that in the Bible we don't find some of this imagery, because some of that is there, especially in the book of Revelation, but that's not how Jesus wants us to stay awake. Staying awake means that we're awake to the fullness of what his second coming really is, which is the consummation of all things. We remind ourselves of the good news of Christ's death, burial, resurrection, his ascension, and his coming, that he's going to reconcile all things to himself. So this shouldn't make us huddle in fear, and it also shouldn't make us act like nothing's going to happen. But rather, we anticipate his coming with gladness. And if you listen to the last chapter of the Bible, this is Revelation 22. I'm going to read a couple of verses from it because it's really good. He says, "Behold, I'm coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price." Do we believe this morning? Do we know this to be true? Because if we do, it doesn't mean that whatever you walked in with this morning, your sin, your suffering, your conflicts, it doesn't mean that that goes away, but it does mean that it's reframed, because it means hope. And that's what I want us to take away from this sermon and this mini-series as a whole, is that it's hope that God knows the end from the beginning, that he is the Alpha and Omega, that he has lived and died and suffered the penalty of sin for those who trust him. And he's coming back. And what he wants from us when we consider this is to have hope. That's how we stay awake. We hope in the return of Jesus, because when we do face trial and persecution and suffering and hardship, that's guaranteed, we do so knowing that the arrival of Jesus is imminent. He's coming back to set everything right. So here's how I want us to close. I wrote a short benediction about the coming of Christ, and I just want to read it over to you as a source of exhortation and meditation. So if you would just do this, if you would close your eyes and bow your heads, I want to read this benediction over us. Here's what the coming of Christ means. I want you to imagine this. The coming of Jesus means justice for you who have been oppressed. It means honor for you who have been shamed. It means hope for you who are in despair. It means all of your tears are replaced with unspeakable joy. It means healing for those stricken with disease. It means new life for a world stained by death. It means our old bodies perished and the resurrected bodies rise. And it means the bride is joined together finally with the bridegroom. It means the arrival of the Lamb, when faith becomes sight and he brings us to himself. This is the good news of the farther mountain range and the distance. And on that mountain, we will dwell with Jesus for eternity upon eternity.